everyone, and welcome to another episode of All Crime, No Cattle. I'm Erin.
And I am Shay.
And we have a punk rock episode for you today. We hope that everyone has been okay since our last episode. We actually came down with some food poisoning, so that was fun for a couple days.
It's just, it's been a hard time these past few weeks, man.
And now we have to find a new favorite pizza place.
That's true. We had this wonderful place that we loved going to. It was a little family place, and now it's ruined for us.
It almost killed us.
Yeah.
But you know what? I always said pizza would be the death of me, so.
That's kind of poignant.
All right, well, what do we have on the docket for today?
Well, today is going to be something different. We've covered a pretty wide range of cases on this show so far, and this week we will be discussing a mix of things that we've touched on and a few that are a little bit unique. One of the first similarities we have in this case takes us back to a familiar town that we covered way back in episode 37. Yep, it's time to head back to the Texas Panhandle and revisit a city nicknamed the Yellow Rose of Texas. Yeah, we're talking about Amarillo. I found this kind of poignant because you just got a Yellow Rose of Texas tattooed on your arm, Erin.
I sure did.
This episode's a little fortuitous for things like that. On this episode, we will be talking also about a case that is from 1997 that put Amarillo in the media spotlight after tensions between two factions of teenagers boiled over into a deadly tragedy. Join us for all of this and more as I take you through episode 54, Hit and Run, the Brian Dennehy story. So sources for this episode include one of our big favorites that we always use. This is the Texas Monthly. And there was a Texas Monthly article about this case back in 1999 by Pamela Koloff. This is a really good article. She interviewed a lot of people close to this case, survivors, family, people that were there on the scene when it happened. She's quickly becoming one of my favorite authors from Texas Monthly. I've used her a couple of times now on the show. I also used the New York Times article from 1999 by Jim Yardley, a Houston Press article from the same year by Julie Lyons. I also took a look at the 2018 film Bomb City, which is kind of a fictitious rendering of the events that happened there. It's a good movie. It's really good. And there's some good actors in it, and they did a really good job of portraying the events. But it is kind of romanticized. It's not very factually correct. But it's also a very good film, so I definitely go ahead and recommend checking it out. But what I do recommend you go and see for sure is the 2020 piece that was done back in 2000. This is a really good little mini documentary that's only 30 minutes long, and it is free on YouTube, so go check that out. So let's start off with saying that Amarillo is not a small town by any means for a Texas town. Back in 1997, they had around 165,000 people living in the greater Amarillo area. About 60% of those people are white, and somewhere around 30% claimed to be Hispanic, Spanish, or Latino during the last census. I think you'll remember from our previous episode that ranching cattle, the freight business, and the manufacture of military weapons are what Amarillo is known for. Thus, another nickname for Amarillo, which is Bomb City, which was the name of that 2018 feature film that I mentioned earlier in our sources. We've also touched on the fact that high school football plays a massive role in the culture of the Lone Star State, and that certainly holds true in towns like Amarillo. If it's high school football season, you can bet that a majority of the eyes and the ears in town will be focused on the next game, the upcoming pep rally, the marching band music, the hallowed glow of Friday night lights, and hopefully by the end of the season, one of those highly coveted spots in the playoffs will be within reach. One Amarillo resident told Texas Monthly, quote, "Teenagers here pay a lot of attention to what your parents do, where they live, what name brand clothing you wear, what church you go to, and what kind of car you drive. If you can't compete, you're an outcast." So what do you do in Amarillo if you're a teenager, an outcast, so to speak, and not at all interested in social norms like high school football? Honestly, you don't do a whole lot. That is, unless you are someone who knows about a secret underneath the surface of this West Texas cowboy town. The truth was that a rich and diverse subculture existed here that strayed away from things like pearl snap shirts, cowboy boots, football, and driving those big Bubba trucks. In 1997, if you look close enough around town, you could see clues of its existence. Unusual street signs with puzzling things were posted in front yards and public areas around town. They said things like, "Road does not end," "Lubbock sucks eggs," "I have traveled a great deal in Amarillo," and "Never stop for anyone." You might even see a stray anarchy symbol painted on the side of a building or two. You'll probably spot a few teenagers sporting denim jackets covered in patches or black leather coats covered in studs. Instead of Western boots, they wore military boots. Some even sported colorful mohawks, facial piercings, and tattoos to stand out. That's right, we're talking about the punk subculture, and specifically a branch of that in 1997 that was thriving in, of all places, Amarillo, Texas. So where did this weird punk subculture out in the West Texas panhandle come from? Well, Pamela Koloff suggested in her Texas Monthly article that Interstate 40 might be responsible for it. For almost 40 years, it's been a major thoroughfare for touring punk bands that were traveling from the central United States back to the West Coast, and specifically Los Angeles. Since the early 80s, seminal punk bands have been stopping off to play small clubs in Amarillo that had picked up on the growing popularity of the punk movement. The anti-establishment ideas, the do-it-yourself attitude, and the promotion of individual freedoms attracted young teens from all over town to come to these shows, and one of those teens was named Brian Dennecke. Originally born in Wichita, Kansas, Brian was the younger of two boys in the Dennecke family. Jason was Brian's older brother by 2 years and had also fallen in love with the punk lifestyle at an early age. Jason shared his books on anti-authoritarianism and his favorite punk albums with his younger brother Brian. Jason was known for his stoic demeanor, being a bookish introvert, and for having an air of toughness about him. His younger brother Brian, however, was the opposite of this. Charming, unguarded, outgoing, and always looking to make others happy. His mother and father had moved the family to Amarillo from Wichita, Kansas in the winter of 1981 when Brian was just 3 years old. During his early life, he was jovial, outgoing, loved the outdoors, was an avid Boy Scout. But over the next 16 years, Brian and Jason would grow to become ensconced in all things counterculture in Amarillo. Brian, however, would come to stand out for all the wrong reasons, even as a young boy. His brother Jason told Texas Monthly, quote, "He never took much of an interest in school, and he wasn't an athletic star. If you're not an athlete here, if you're not part of that culture, you're nothing. It was difficult for Brian to fit in," end quote. And you know, Aaron, I think this probably resonates with you because you were into punk music as a young teen. So what was that like for you growing up in kind of a satellite town outside of Fort Worth?
Yeah, I mean, I've talked about it before. I grew up in Weatherford and I was definitely a punk kid. I was really into punk music. I didn't necessarily go full throttle into the subculture. You know, I didn't dress necessarily like a punk and I didn't feel like I needed to wear it on my sleeve. You know what
so
I mean?
You didn't have like safety pins all over your plaid jeans?
No, but I definitely was friends with people who dressed that way and were really into having that as a part of their identity. I'm probably a few years younger than what these kids were at the time. Back in 1997, I was in junior high. But yeah, probably a lot of parallels. The only difference being is that in Weatherford, at least at the time, we did not have a very good football team. And as far as I'm aware, the football aspect of it really wasn't present. That being said, I was very disconnected from any of that anyway, so maybe it was important to people and I just wasn't aware of it. But but yeah, I've heard this story before and I feel like I would have been these kids' friends. I would like these were my people.
I feel like at the Thursday or Friday pep rally that was right before the big game, whether your team was good or not, you were probably at the top of the stands making fun of the pep rally.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And that would be exactly what Brian and his brother Jason would have been doing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, were you ever into skateboarding or did you hang out with a bunch of skateboard kids?
I hung out with the skateboard kids. Yeah. You know me. I have no sense of balance. Yeah. I can't skateboard.
I hung out with the skateboard kids, too.
Well, we got a skateboard park is what they called it. It was a couple of ramps or whatever. but they built it in Weatherford sometime when I was in high school, and that was kind of like the hangout spot for us cool kids.
Oh, that was probably like counterculture headquarters,
man. In Weatherford? Yeah. It was like the one place.
Well, Brian also picked up skateboarding at an early age, and by 13, he had immediately fallen in love with this part of the subculture of punk music. Soon, his skateboard became his ever-present companion, and what got him from the local record store to the Dairy Queen, or when he could manage it, a local punk show. And he was known for slipping into punk shows at an underage level. So that's kind of cool.
That's really cool.
Yeah. He would have been like real rad at my school for that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. He sounds pretty cool.
Well, he met other skateboarders and punk fans like himself through his middle school years, and by the time Brian made it to high school, his image had changed from an innocent former Boy Scout to a kid who had just kind of like learned how to ride a skateboard to an extremely edgy teen with the beginnings of a green mohawk. His father said, quote, "We thought that if we didn't accept him, we would lose him. You got to the point where you could keep battling with your children, but you realize you're not going to change them." He had a real strong opinion that it shouldn't matter how he had his hair or how he dressed. Even though he was right in a theoretical sense that it did not matter, we knew that society was going to judge him and that there were going to be consequences. End quote. And you know, I think that's a really good point by his parents. And my parents did the same thing with me when I got really into the deep heavy metal culture when I got into high school. I got kind of extreme and started wearing black shirts and trench coats and dyed my hair black and joined a cover band for heavy metal music. And my parents got to the same kind of point where it's like, well, you either accept them or you just ostracize your child. And so I can totally relate to that.
Yeah, definitely. It sounds like his parents were supportive and still loved him and cared about him. So that's really fantastic. But I can also see as a parent being like, people are going to judge you and kind of being worried about your child for what the outside world is going to think about how your kid dresses or what kind of music they listen to.
Because you want to protect your kid, right?
Of course.
And you know people are going to judge them for stuff like that.
Yeah, people are horrible and mean.
Yeah, well, eventually Brian's determination won out and his look became one of the more iconic and extreme ones of the late 90s in Amarillo's punk scene. He used gelatin to hold up his now 12-inch plus long mohawk that was dyed blue, by the way, into its perfect shape. And he covered his arms with as many tattoos as he could afford or get his friends to put on him for free. He pierced his nose and painted his nails, began wearing a spiked dog collar around his neck, and wore shirts that said things like "destroy everything" from his favorite band Filth. People around town definitely took notice of this. The look of punks in Amarillo during this time was quite varied. Some wore black clothes, plaid, or denim. Others habitually wore thick black eyeliner, and a few took the more extreme route, like Brian. Needless to say, Brian stuck out like a sore thumb on his skateboard as he went from school to his home or to his part-time job. It also meant that he was an easy target for those that didn't agree with his lifestyle. Over the next year, Brian was jumped several times and beaten up by fellow classmates or even men in their early 20s. Sometimes, if they didn't jump him outright, they would simply drive behind him, yelling and berating him while he tried to skate away, all the while calling him things like pussy, freak, or worse. While riding his board at night, Brian got really good at avoiding potholes, but he was also really good at dodging incoming beer bottles thrown at him from passing cars and trucks. After a particularly severe beating that caused Brian to get several stitches to the head and face, some of his friends began jokingly referring to him as Fist Magnet and urged him to carry protection. Brian started wearing a heavy chain fashioned through his belt loops with a big padlock on the end. This is a known weapon of convenience in the punk scene, also referred to as a smiley, for its smile-shaped mark that the padlock leaves on its victims. More simply put, it's an effective bludgeoning weapon that wouldn't draw immediate charges if you got stopped by the cops.
So it's just a big padlock on a chain?
Yeah, like a big physical chain that you would like kind of close a gate with or something. You know, not like a little tiny chain, but one of those big link chains.
Yeah, and then would the padlock be hanging off a, of the length of the chain so you could swing the chain and hit somebody with it? Or
it's just what closes it together. And then you take your keys that are probably hanging off of your chain wallet.
Oh, and then you physically take the whole thing off.
Take the whole thing off and you use it like a beating weapon, like a bludgeoning weapon.
Sure.
By his sophomore year in high school, Brian believed he had taken enough punishment. After some fellow students tried taunting him into a fight, Brian instead chunked a large rock through one of their car windows and took off. The damage to the vehicle earned him a trip to juvenile hall and a probationary punishment for vandalism. Instead of serving the probation, Brian dropped out of school and quickly earned his GED. You see, Brian was smart and self-sufficient, even if his temper got the best of him sometimes. He got a part-time job, moved out of his parents' house, saved up some money, and developed a plan to leave Amarillo and head out to the East Coast for good. And just like that, his long-term girlfriend, Jennifer, he and his rescue dog hitched rides out east. They did odd jobs along the way, took handouts, food scraps, they did some cleaning of big rigs at truck stops for cash, and even did a fair amount of panhandling to make ends meet. After 4 months of living the hard life on the U.S. highways out east, Brian and Jennifer decided they had enough, and they returned back to their friends and families in Amarillo. This time, Brian was determined, though, to make a difference and stand out for something in his hometown. By early 1997, when Brian returned to Texas, he had begun working for the famous local Amarillo artist slash prankster named Stanley Marsh III. Marsh had made a name for himself back in the 1970s as an avant-garde artist willing to push the boundaries in small West Texas urban towns. Our Texas listeners will probably be familiar with Stanley Marsh III's work for his iconic Cadillac Ranch project, which features a series of upright and buried old Cadillacs along the Texas roadside. This was a big deal. He was like this weird artist that lived out in the middle of West Texas that did stuff like this.
Okay, that's interesting. That sounds like a perfect sort of creative outlet for him.
Yeah. By the late 90s, Stanley Marsh had begun exploring how to install local art into small town suburbia. He established what he referred to as the Dynamite Museum. It was an idea that would result in hundreds and thousands of artistically modified street signs being installed around town on private property as well as public property. It's one of the biggest public art installations ever. Brian Dinicky volunteered for this project and had an immediate impact. Brian's first job was one of outreach. He would travel around Amarillo door to door and proposition residents to allow the Dynamite Museum to put a sign in their yard. These are some of the signs we talked about at the beginning of the episode with weird little sayings on them. Well, Marsh told Texas Monthly, quote, "He looked bizarre, but he could walk towards people with his hand out, grinning, and they would like him before he got to their front door. For this reason, I called him Sunshine. He was boisterous, optimistic, fun, so Sunshine just stuck."
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
He sounds like such a nice kid, like a really cool kid, you know?
Yeah, man, he definitely loved the community, and he loved his town, he loved his family, and he just wanted a place, and he just wanted to represent himself, and that's going to be a problematic thing moving forward for Brian. Well, as Brian began to establish himself as a massive part of the underground punk art and music scene in Amarillo, Texas, he began to have a huge hand in maintaining the 8th Street House, a safe place for young punk teens that also catered to traveling and local punk artists. Although Brian was still a constant target and a fist magnet, so to speak, he knew he was not the only punk in town that was being targeted with violence. The 8th Street House wasn't pretty. It was a hole in the wall as far as music venues were concerned, but it meant so much to their community and the movement to have a nice, safe place for punks to hang out. A local punk told Texas Monthly, quote, "Brian's main goal, and he saved a whole lot of money for it, was to start an all-age place for bands, poetry, art, and theater. He wanted to have a place where kids could hang out, be in their own element, and not get harassed by a bunch of drunk rednecks. He wanted to give everyone something constructive to do with their free time."
That sounds awesome. I would have been so down with that as like a 17-year-old. I'm down with that now. That sounds pretty cool, to be honest.
Well, you remember the Annex. It was a club in Fort Worth that a bunch of underground bands, indie bands, metal bands used to go play at. We did a bunch of shows there. It's the same kind of idea, just like a little hole in the wall where it's a safe place. Everybody can go and make music.
Yeah, it's just a little tiny community that people have created for themselves where everybody knows each other and is supportive of one another. So totally down with this whole idea, totally down with what he's doing. It sounds really great. I mean, he's dropped out of school and he's found a place for himself.
Yeah. And, you know, the movie Bomb City focuses on this particular venue and his efforts to make it work a lot. If you want more about what was going on with that kind of scene and the underground punk community in this particular venue, the movie definitely explores that. Well, howdy, guys and gals. Here in the U.S., we just celebrated Memorial Day, and because of that, I ask you this. Can you have superior quality grooming goods for hardworking men and women? I'm here to tell you yes. Yes, you can. Are you looking for a company that partners with active duty military to develop new ideas as well as reviewing products? If you are, I'm happy to introduce you to this company. Duke Cannon is committed to giving back to the men and women serving our country. That's why a portion of their proceeds directly supports veterans' causes. That means anything that does not meet the high standards of soldiers doesn't happen as far as their company is concerned. Duke Cannon sells basically everything a tough guy or gal could ever need, such as big-ass bricks of soap, news anchor pomades, beard washes, shaving creams, and solid fragrances. Some of their featured scents are barley, sandalwood, and of course, my favorite, shea butter. I really enjoy their selection of goods, and so does Erin. She definitely noticed once I started using their hair creams, body washes, and hand creams. From one dapper gentleman to another, don't let this ad pass you by without clicking on the link in the episode's notes. Visit DukeCannon.com, that's DukeCannon.com, right now and get 15% off of your order with the promo code CATTLE. And you'll also receive free shipping on any order of $35 or more. Take it from me, you want that shea butter. Well, hello, ACNC Posse. I know that you guys love listening to All Crime, No Cattle. That's why you're here. But did you know that you can actually get paid for listening to your favorite podcasts? I know it sounds really crazy, but we just discovered this free app called Podcoin, and it does actually pay you for listening to your favorite podcasts. How it works is you listen to whatever podcast you want to listen to, whether that's How Did This Get Made, Serial, My Favorite Murder, whatever, us, obviously, and that earns you Podcoin while you are listening. You take that, you turn around and use those Podcoins to buy gift cards at places like Amazon or Starbucks. If you're an awesome human being, you could donate all that Podcoin that you've earned back to a nonprofit or some kind of charity. But the more that you listen, the more you earn, so the more powerful you become as a listener. So here's what you do. You download the app right now on iPhone or the Android app, and you have a special code that you're going to need to use. So simply use a code CATTLE, and you'll get 300 extra Podcoin just for signing up. And if you listen to enough of us or whatever your favorite podcast is, then you can get some kind of beverage at Starbucks, or maybe you can get some awesome gift card at Amazon that you can rent a movie, or you can buy some toilet paper. You know, something that you might need. I'm not here to judge what you need. Amazon is the place to buy things, so get yourself an Amazon gift card by listening to us. Go listen to any kind of podcast, get yourself some Podcoin, and then sign up with that code CATTLE, and I swear this will be a new whole world for podcasting for you. You're going to want to listen to more shows than you ever have before. All right, back to the show, guys. We've talked a little bit about the subculture of the punk movement in Amarillo, Texas, and now we're going to kind of switch gears a little bit. So in a nearby area of town, close to where Brian Dennehy lived, on the edge of a middle-class white neighborhood, so much was different. In 1997, Dustin Camp was a junior at Tascosa High School in Amarillo, Texas. He had a slight build, he was a little bit short, but he had a winning smile, and he was very popular and outgoing. Dustin came from an average home just a couple of blocks away from one of the poorest areas of town, but Dustin acted like the rest of Amarillo's elite upper-class youths. Dustin seemed to want to do something more. He made friends with teenagers who came from old money and the nicer side of Amarillo. You see, Dustin had gone a different direction from Brian. Dustin was also very likable and charismatic, but he used his charm and joking nature to try and elevate his social status to blend in with the rich kids of the preps and jocks. Some of them made the occasional jokes about his 15-year-old Cadillac that he drove, but they accepted him. When Dustin wasn't working out, hammering down extra food in an attempt to bulk up, or helping down at his father's auto repair shop, he was practicing for football. It was said that Dustin had a hyper-focus on finally making the varsity squad that year. He was a bit short and not particularly muscular, but his passion to play the game was very apparent. The Camp family were also large donors and supporters to the Tascosa High School football team. But most of Dustin's friends and classmates had already been promoted from the JV team up to the varsity team a year earlier. So the pressure was on Dustin to either finally make it on the team or give up his dreams of playing under the Friday Night Lights forever. Some of Dustin's friends loved to party. Underage drinking in high schools around the country is not new, and it was pretty typical behavior for students in Amarillo back in 1997. Dustin, like many teens his age, drank beer and alcohol with his friends at weekend keggers, post-game bonfires, and house parties. He and his friends were immediately identifiable in their rebel letter jackets and white baseball caps bearing the names of colleges with top-ranked football teams such as Notre Dame or Michigan. Punk kids started referring to them as white hats for their unofficial uniform. Sometimes Dustin and his friends would have too much to drink and would head out to search for something or someone to take out their pent-up teenage anger and aggression on. So they'd drive around town late at night, get something to eat perhaps, and then start looking for some unknowing punks to harass. Most of the time, they would try to bait a young punk teen or small group into a fistfight, throw a few punches, and then take off. One such night on Saturday, December 6th, 1997, a small fight broke out at a local IHOP. Dustin Camp and his friends were said to have taunted and heckled a group of punk teens into a fight in the nearby parking lot there on Western Street in Amarillo. The IHOP was a known place for punk kids to hang out after hours, grab some coffee, and listen to some music in the parking lot. The jocks likely knew this, and therefore it was a great place to go looking for a fight. Their main target was John King, a member of the punk community who had crossed them before. John King was a close friend of Brian Dennehy. Witnesses at the scene claim that while the scuffle was going on in the parking lot, a car came flying out of nowhere at the group of punks. Witnesses also told police that Dustin Camp was behind the wheel of this vehicle. He drove his tan Cadillac up behind the group of punks, attempting to run them down unknowingly. Kendra Pettit, a punk who was there that night, told the Houston Press, quote, "He came up behind the punks. I'll never know how they moved so fast, but they jumped out of the way just in time. He was trying to hit them. He had it floored. His tires were screeching," end quote. Luckily, Dustin missed, and as he sped by, John King pulled out a police baton that he carried for protection and smashed Dustin's windshield. Dustin peeled out of the parking lot onto Western Street as the punks screamed insults at him for trying to hit them with his car. Though Dustin's friends denied this event ever even happened, members of the punk community who were there that night all tell the same story. They were also very terrified. A story of a jock trying to hit some punks with his car at the local IHOP spread through the community like wildfire.
So he full-on just drove into a group of people hoping to mow people down?
Yes.
Okay.
And you could see how scary that would be, right? And
absolutely,
how terrifying it would be. If you're already a group of people who are outcast, who are marginalized, who are on the edge of Amarillo society, and you're already worried about protecting yourselves, and then you get attacked by a jock with a car in a parking lot at a local hangout, it's terrifying.
Yeah, a local hangout, which is probably one of the few places that you and your crew hang out. So you're going to be back. You're always going to be on edge.
Yeah.
Knowing that, oh, okay, this is the new thing that we're going to have to worry about.
That's right. So after this story began to spread around the community, More kids and teens started carrying weapons like knives, clubs, chains, and pepper spray to protect themselves. They told each other to try and travel in groups for safety and not to be out at night alone because the white hats were out for blood. Over the next few days, several more punk teens were jumped, beaten, and harassed around town by high school football players. Tensions in Dustin's circles seemed to ratchet up as well. A week later, rumors started to spread around the high school that the football players were wanting payback for what had been done to Dustin's windshield. A large group of jocks planned to meet up at the same parking lot outside the IHOP for a rematch against some of the punks that were brave enough to try and take them on. Dustin made plans to be there that night. On Friday, December 12, 1997, Dustin Camp and two friends, Rob Mansfield, a varsity tight end football player, and Elise Thompson, an honor student at Tascosa High School, drove down Western Street towards the IHOP. They rode in Dustin's 1983 Cadillac. In the floorboard were several beer cans and a mostly finished off bottle of whiskey. As the IHOP and the Western Plaza Shopping Center came into view, the three of them saw a large group of football players and students facing off with what many said was a much smaller group of punks. According to Jason Denneke, his brother Brian, John King, himself, and some friends had come to get a bite to eat at their usual hangout, but the jocks had blocked the door of the IHOP and started picking a fight immediately. The manager of the IHOP saw what was going on, got angry, came out and told them they needed to leave and disperse, and this whole large group moved to a neighboring parking lot in the same shopping center. Jackie Balderez, one of the punks that was with them that night, told the Houston Press, quote, "We were all drinking and stuff. We had heard the rumors and knew that there was a big chance of a fight. It was kind of stupid to go up there," end quote. The punks may have had fewer numbers, numbering 5 men and 4 women, but they had their makeshift weapons on them as always for protection. They stood in a face-off with these taunting jocks who were hurling insults, throwing beer bottles, and even spitting on them. Witnesses from the IHOP and the neighboring parking lot said that the jocks numbered as many as 40 to 50 teens. Seeing the scene and expecting a fight to break out at any minute, Elise Thompson told Dustin in the car to take her and Rob home. Dustin refused, and instead followed the group to that neighboring area of the parking lot with his Cadillac, pulled into the parking lot, and drove towards the conflict. About this time, the two groups surged. They attacked each other. It was hard to say who moved first or who threw the initial punch, but it quickly escalated into a full-on brawl, with separate fights spaced out across this small area. Jackie Balderez told 2020 that a group of jocks headed straight for Brian almost immediately. She said, quote, "There was like 10 to 15 guys around him, just kicking him and hitting him and beating him up. He was just, like, taking it. He was, like, in a fetal position on the ground," end quote. As the brawl reached a frenzy, the sound of a car engine approached. It was Dustin, weaving through the crowd of onlookers, jocks, and punks with his Cadillac. Dustin spotted one of his friends, Andrew McCullough, being beaten by two punks, and he steered his car in that direction. Dustin clipped one of the jocks, Chris Oles, with the side of his fender and sent him sprawling onto the car's hood. The young teen looked inside the vehicle in terror before he was slung over the side and back onto the pavement. Punks nearby began striking Dustin's car, and his friend Rob yelled to Dustin from the passenger seat, quote, "Let's get out of here." At first, Dustin seemed to agree and headed towards the exit of the parking lot. Suddenly, he turned the car around and headed back towards the brawl. He began picking up speed. Off to the side of the main group was a beaten and bloodied Brian Denneke, still fending off one of the jocks. As the headlights beamed onto the two men, they reportedly stopped their altercation with each other and split up. Witnesses who were there that night saw Brian turn and run. Dustin kept his foot on the gas and drove straight for the running Brian. Dustin jumped a median and hit Brian from behind with the grill of his car. Brian's back slapped against the hood of the Cadillac with a vicious crunch. Brian's body lay there for a split second just before it was ripped underneath the vehicle by the pavement. Chris Oles, who had been hit first by Dustin's car, watched as the vehicle crushed his friend. He told the Houston Press, quote, "You know those lowrider cars? That's what it looked like. It just went over the top of him and bounced," end quote. Elise Thompson told 2020 in her interview that she, quote, felt two bumps as I was praying those bumps had been the median and not his body, end quote. Elise also told Texas Monthly that Dustin said a weird thing just after the collision with Brian. He said, quote, I'm a ninja in my caddy, and I bet he liked that one, end quote. The Cadillac turned and sped out of the parking lot, leaving the bloodied body of Brian Dinicky laying motionless on the ground in a collection of snow near the median. Elise later told the Houston Press, quote, Dustin was heading for the highway after we left, and like, from the moment we hit him till we got on the highway, he was completely silent. It seemed like forever. And then I started like freaking out, rocking back and forth and stuff, and just covered my face. Then I started saying, oh my God, over and over again. And then I sat up and I leaned into the front seat and they were completely silent sitting there. I said, what if he's dead? And then no one said anything. End quote. Brian's brother Jason ran to his side where his body lay resting in that snowbank. Jason was the first to reach Brian. He told 2020, quote, there was just a lot of blood. He was just coughing up blood and bleeding from everywhere. Brian was conscious for a few moments as he tried to make out a few words to his brother. But as others started to arrive, no one could make out what he was saying through the pain and the severity of his injuries. The truth was, Brian's front teeth had been shattered. A deep gash ran down the side of his face, and another down his torso. His left shoulder had been completely ripped out of the joint and fractured. This resulted in the complete tearing of most of his left shoulder and his back muscles in the process. A later autopsy would reveal that Brian suffered multiple skull fractures. Both arms and one leg were fractured multiple times. Several of Brian's vertebrae were broken, and he had also suffered a complete severing of his spinal cord. Multiple of Brian's ribs were completely crushed, his pelvis almost completely shattered. Due to his injuries, Brian was losing massive amounts of blood to internal bleeding and organ damage from the impact. He was also bleeding from everywhere on his crushed head and skull. Justin held his brother for a few moments as the jocks and preps began to disperse. As they left, they cheered and high-fived each other in their victory. One even yelled out, "Yeehaw!" None of the jocks stopped to see what had happened to Brian, much less give any aid. Brian Dinicky died in his brother's arms a few minutes later. In the crime scene photos, his body was shown resting in a crumpled, unnatural position in a blood-soaked patch of snow near that median that Dustin's Cadillac ramped over. A handful of jocks and punks ended up in the hospital that night, with concussions and minor injuries due to the brawl. Later that month, a large memorial for Brian was held on the spot where he was killed. After the impact, Dustin Camp drove Rob and Elise home. Along the way, he told them no one had to face the police but him. He instructed Rob and Elise to lie and say they hadn't been in the car that night. He drove himself home, he parked his car, and he went upstairs to bed. Elise and Rob both couldn't sleep that night, and they were restless, and they ended up coming clean to their parents about what had happened and voluntarily went down to the police station to give a statement. The next morning at 6 a.m., officers from Amarillo Police Department arrived at the Camp home. Dustin lied to police, saying he was the only one in the car, and that he was trying to help his friend when Brian slipped on the ice and unfortunately fell underneath his vehicle. The investigating officers took several blood, hair, and tissue samples from the undercarriage of Dustin's vehicle. They also photographed body damage to the fender and hood of the vehicle. Sergeant Rudy Montano was the lead investigator on the case, and he told 2020, quote, it was not an accident. It was a deliberate act. That was very clear to us from the evidence. In the car's trunk, they also found an 18-can case of Bud Light with 13 of the cans missing. Next to it was the mostly empty bottle of Crown Royal whiskey. Shortly after the search of the vehicle was concluded, Dustin was arrested and charged with the murder of Brian Dinicky. Police investigators pieced together both sides of the story of Brian's death and the brawl in the parking lot from those that had been injured at the hospital and people who had volunteered their statements at the station. In their report, they called it a case of the White Hats versus the Freaks. Investigators believed it was a pretty clear case of first-degree murder on the part of Dustin Camp. But as we all know, sometimes things don't go to plan in a courtroom. Dustin's trial took over a year and a half to begin. So in the spring of 1999, in her valedictorian speech, Elise Thompson spoke about her experience that fateful night. This happens at the same graduation that Dustin Camp was allowed to walk across the stage to an applause of his fellow students and peers. Quote, "On that evening, a boy lost his life, and with him a part of many people died. It was a fight over what clothes people wear and what side of town they live on. Nothing else I've experienced has so greatly molded me and who I am and what I think than this. I hope its message can penetrate your heart, so I challenge you and me, all of us, to break through the stereotypes with which you have been raised. I challenge each one of us to see the art and the beauty of humanity in others." In August of 1999, Dustin's defense attorney, Warren L. Clark, built a two-tier defense. First, he claimed that Dustin had acted in defense of a friend whom Brian Dennehy was attacking. Second, he demonized Brian and his friends in the entire Amarillo punk community. He used words like goons, thugs, and sociopaths to describe them. He pointed to the weapons that they carried for protection as tools of violence and disorder. Warren Clark told the jury at one point, quote, "This is not a case of diversity or tolerance or judging people by the way that they dress. This is about a gang of young men who chose a lifestyle designated to intimidation of those around them, to challenge authority, and to provoke a reaction from others."
It's always nice when the defense is just literal victim shaming.
Oh, yeah. This is straight up victim shaming from Warren Clark,
yeah,
for sure. And I've got a lot of things to say about Warren Clark, but I'm going to hold those to the end of the episode. Warren Clark also used the fact that the punks had armed themselves as proof that a, quote, "conspiracy was put into play to kill and maim these high school students that had nothing to do with any kind of provocation to these other students."
So they're saying that the jocks were just the innocent victims all of this.
They just showed up to get some pancakes.
And the fact that this guy mowed them down in a vehicle.
Yeah.
It's fine. That's understandable. Okay.
Well, here's the worst part. He finished with a shocking proclamation that, quote, "Dustin had no time to think or ponder. He had to take immediate action, and he took it. And if he had to live it all over again, he would do it again." This is a point that 2020 pressured Warren Clark on for clarification about what he meant during a later interview. When asked if Clark really believed that Dustin would do the same thing all over again, even though that implies he wouldn't choose to tap the brakes, stop and turn the car around, or simply just swerve to avoid Brian, knowing that he was about to kill him, Clark said this, quote, "It was about loyalty. It may have been misdirected loyalty, but it was out of loyalty to his friend." Prosecutors argued that Dustin's actions were not in defense of his friend or out of a sense of honor or loyalty, but rather fueled by a drunken rage. Elise Thompson, who was in Dustin's car, who had graduated the previous spring before the trial as a valedictorian of her class, testified for the prosecution. She spoke about Dustin's demeanor in the car. She said, "It was not one of a panicked youth after an accident, but the opposite." Quote, "Dustin's fault that night lay in intimidation and in fear, but what he did was still wrong. A lot of people tried to defend him, but you cannot defend what he did. He was out to hurt someone that night," end quote. So I think that's pretty damning from his friend who was in the car with him that evening.
Yeah, and especially because there are multiple witnesses who say that this was the second time he pulled this, "I'm going to ram my vehicle through this group of people" trick.
Yeah, and the prosecution made sure to bring that up, that early event that the jocks say, "Oh, well, that never happened."
Yeah.
The prosecution also noted how Dustin had lied to police and claimed that it was all a terrible accident at first, but then later changed his story to a version where his actions were in defense of his friend. You know, because at first Brian slipped on the ice and he just fell underneath his car.
Yeah, but then when the hard evidence disproved that, it was, "Oh, okay, well, I'm really the hero. I was doing this to save somebody else."
Exactly. And then speaking of hard evidence, evidence at the crime scene showed that tire marks of Dustin's vehicle accelerated towards the pursuit of Brian as he attempted to run away. There was no sign of Dustin ever hitting the brakes or trying to alter his course. This matches the testimony of Brian's friends who were there that night, who went up on the stand and testified to what they had seen. Also, I'll say that Jason Denneke went up on the stand and gave a very tearful recounting of exactly what he saw as the car sped across the parking lot, ramped off the median and hit his brother, and then he ran over there and held him until he passed away. And that gave a really strong reaction from a lot of the punk community that was there and the families, as well as the jury. Evidence at the crime scene, specifically marks that were taken from the pavement around the crime scene, showed that Dustin's car, when it hit the median just before colliding with Brian's body, was likely traveling somewhere between 45 and 50 miles an hour. Marks in the asphalt showed that Dustin's car was traveling fast enough to cause the car to launch some 14 feet in the air before hitting the pavement again.
Jeez.
Yeah. During final arguments, Warren Clark painted his client as a church-going, all-American, 18-year-old athlete who had above-average grades and was destined for college. What he said to the jury next, in front of Brian's friends and family, was shocking. And I'll go as far as to say it was downright deplorable. Allow me to read the entire full quote. "What Dustin Camp faced out there was a mean drunk with a weapon. Somewhere in the infinite processes that made a boy into a man, something happened to Brian Denneke. His manner of death was unfortunately the end result of his choices over the last 6 years prior to his death. You could even argue that he was destined to die the way he did that night. He was a violent individual. It took violence on Dustin's part to put an end to further violence and to save an innocent's life. Let this boy go home. Restore him to his family. Because he did the right thing." End quote.
How unbelievably outraged would you be if you were Brian Denneke's family?
Oh, dude.
If you are his mother, if you are his father, sitting in that courtroom and you hear somebody say that about your son.
Not only is it bad enough that some a-hole who was drunk ran your son down with a vehicle, and then you have this asshat, Warren Clark, who gets up there and vilifies your son, his entire community and movement in Amarillo, Texas, in front of everyone. It's awful.
So I'm hoping that the jury saw through this.
Well, the jury deliberated for 3 hours. When they returned, they delivered their verdict. They found Dustin Camp guilty of manslaughter and not first-degree murder.
Wow.
In their view, Dustin had acted with recklessness, but not with ill intent. Manslaughter charges typically bring with them a sentence of 2 to 20 years in prison. However, in this case, the jury was allowed to give a sentence of just probation, since Dustin had no previous criminal record to speak of. Dustin walked out of the courtroom that day with a 10-year probation term. He would not serve a single day in jail, a single hour in prison for his crime.
Are you joking with me right now?
No.
How do I not remember this part of the case?
Nobody does. Nobody remembers this part. Everyone remembers a punk kid that got run over by a car because the punks were feuding with the jocks. Nobody remembers this part. He did receive a fine of $10,000, though. But this was later dropped in an appeal because of his good behavior. Dustin Camp basically had the chance to receive a penalty of nothing for his role in Brian's death. Your face is pretty ridiculous at this moment.
I just can't believe that that's even a possibility. That's, I mean, please tell me that there's some kind of justice comes out of all of this.
Well, the thing is that Dustin did screw up. In June of 2001, Dustin was arrested for underage drinking. His father, Michael Camp, tried to bury these charges and cover up his son's probation violations, but he was caught red-handed by investigators. For his part, his father received 60 days of probation and a $100 fine, but that meant that Dustin actually did end up going to prison to serve a portion of this manslaughter charge, and in 2001, he got an 8-year sentence for violating his parole. In 2006, Dustin was paroled under supervision to serve out the remainder of his sentence, which expired in 2009.
So this guy walks away scot-free after mowing somebody down and he just continues to just drink.
Yeah.
I mean, he just violates his probation just willy-nilly like it was nothing.
Well, and he also didn't get charged with this, but initially he was found to be aiding and abetting minors in the use of alcohol. So he went and bought a bunch of alcohol for a bunch of minors, got drunk, drove his car, then got arrested 3 years after this happened.
Wow. Well, I mean, I hate to say it, but I'm kind of glad that he violated his probation, because at least that's kind of closer to what you would have expected him to get in the first place.
Right. But, you know, the Denneke family was obviously left destroyed by all of this. And,
oh, sure.
Yeah. And I agree with what Brian's father told 2020 when he said, quote, "It's a joke. It's just a slap on the wrist. And he screwed up. Sometimes I still wonder if Dustin realizes what he really did. Does he realize that he murdered someone who could have contributed a lot to society and who was a really good person?" End quote. Dan Kelso also talked to Texas Monthly, and he was a co-worker and friend of Brian's, and he said, quote, "Brian was the candle burning the fastest and brightest in the community. People gravitated towards him. He was the face of the punk scene here. He was visible, smiling, standing tall, always willing to help. When he was killed, part of these kids died too," end quote. Lastly, I wanted to talk a little bit more about Dustin's attorney, Warren Clark. He was asked by 2020 if the tables were turned and it had been Brian behind the wheel and Dustin who had been hit by the car that night, would it have been the same result? Which I think is an interesting question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Clark responded, quote, "With Mr. Denneke's past, it would have been very hard to keep him out of prison. Plus, let's face it, appearances mean something. It means something in Amarillo, Texas, and it means something in New York City. Sometimes the conclusions we reach on appearances are improper and not justified, but in a murder case, they're pretty damn important." So I think that's interesting for two reasons, because Warren Clark kind of let his guard down for a second and he started telling the truth about his strategy as a lawyer in this case. This completely tears apart his defense that this crime was based on self-defense for the loyalty of his friend who was being beaten up by a punk in a parking lot, or not motivated by appearances, lifestyle choices, or hatred for punks like Brian. This whole comment by him tears that all apart, because he's saying that appearances matter, and the way that Brian looks matters, and if they had been switched, and it had been Brian driving the car, he would have gone to jail for murder.
Yeah, so he's admitting that the jury had automatic prejudices when it came to Brian and when it came to Dustin, and were able to make leaps regarding what their intentions were just based on those things. And he was able to tailor his defense to exploit that fact.
Yeah, it's just vilifying an outcast and an outcast community.
Yeah.
You know, he used every point that he could in that trial, like the fact that they had pepper spray for protection. It was like, oh, well, that's a weapon for anti-establishment culture and to cause chaos. You know, it's okay. It's not to protect yourself from somebody who's trying to, yeah, to beat you up.
Literally,
in the dark
alley. That's all pepper spray is for, is, yeah, just for self-defense. Nobody goes on a violent spree with pepper spray. You know what I mean? Like,
a dirty
what?
Pepper spraying spree?
What the hell?
He had no answer for that previous event where Dustin Camp tried to run over the punks the week earlier.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's, for me, it's a very early example of the affluenza teen syndrome. We kind of saw this in the case in episode 2 that we covered, Lance Butterfield, where he's accepted in his community. You know, he has a reputation and people aren't willing to give him the harshest of punishments. It's like what we see in Brock Turner and Ethan Couch, these other affluenza teens, where they get just a slap on the wrist. They're a football player, they're blonde, they make pretty good grades, they're going to go to college. Like, F these punk kids and the rest of their community that's all interested in art and reading books about anti-authoritarianism and putting up goofy signs around town. They're not the football team kids. They're not the kids that are going to go to college and represent us. They're not us.
Yeah. And that's something that I think people are increasingly becoming aware of and knowledgeable about it, which is how the justice system is not fair. It is not the same across the board for, you know, depending on who you are, how much money you have, what your race is, what your sex is, all of those things become differing factors in how you are sentenced. And that is not okay.
Yeah. If you just looked at the forensics of this case, if you looked at the tire marks, the marks that were caused by the bolts on the shocks that hit the ground after the 14 feet that the car traveled, you know, how he didn't veer, how he didn't hit his brakes. I mean, he murdered him.
Yeah.
Clearly. And that's exactly what the investigator saw, who wrote the report and handed it over to the DA. He got away with murder.
Yeah. I do wonder, too, just the fact, because it seems like there's a lot of cases like this where it's vehicular homicide or vehicular manslaughter. And if somehow the fact that it's a vehicle that is used as the weapon, if that's somehow harder to prove intent or something within a court of law, anybody out there who is knowledgeable in lawyerly stuff?
Yeah.
Anybody out there who's knowledgeable about the law, if you could kind of comment and chip in on that, because I think that is an interesting aspect. Is there something about hurting somebody or killing somebody with a car that makes it harder to prove intent, which makes it harder to prosecute, like a first degree murder type of sentence or something like that?
I think innately it is. And the whole time the prosecution had witnesses to say that they saw him accelerate towards Brian. But then, you know, the defense on the other side had all of the jocks, the fellow teammates that were saying, oh, I mean, clearly that's not what happened. It was an accident. Brian slipped on the ice, which we know that that's probably not what happened. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of the defense does a good job of turning it into a he said, she said kind of situation. And making that vague ambiguity to where you could switch it from first degree murder into vehicular manslaughter.
Yeah.
And that's just an element of the legal system.
Yeah. And it's a very frustrating one.
Yeah. But I think it's a very important case. And to this day, Brian is still remembered very, very heavily and very strongly. There's still people that meet and do memorials in that parking lot where the IHOP is and that Western Plaza shopping center.
All right. Well, that's, you know, another one of these really interesting and frustrating cases. We would love to hear what you guys think about it. Do you think justice was served? Do you think that if this case was tried today, would we have seen a difference in the resolution of the case, in the sentencing of this case? You know, there's a lot of discussion points I think you could talk about, a lot of things to think about. But while you're thinking about all that, in the meantime, I've got some good news for you.
Hey guys, I know some of you out there who listen to the show, you probably travel, right? Well, Aaron and I do too, and what does everybody need when they're traveling? Luggage. Well, I have something for you today, and it's called Away. Away Luggage uses high-quality materials while offering a much lower price compared to other brands by cutting out the middleman and selling directly to you. Choose from 9 colors and 4 sizes. All the suitcases are made with premium German polycarbonate, which is super tough. The interior features a patent-pending compression system, helpful for people like me and Aaron who are overpackers and put way too much in the suitcase. These bags are TSA approved with their combination locks that are specially built into the top of the bag to prevent theft. Both sizes of the carry-on are able to charge all cell phones, tablets, e-readers, and anything else that's powered by a USB cord. These pieces of luggage also have a lifetime warranty. If anything breaks, they will fix it and replace it for you for life. And if at any point you decide it's not for you, return it for a full refund, no questions asked. There is free shipping on any Away order within the lower 48 states. The carry-on sizes are compliant with all major U.S. airlines. These bags are great for us because there's so many times where we want to charge our phones or use an electrical device and not worry about them going dead while we're traveling. We got the black, and it's super sleek. It looks very durable. So for a special offer, make sure you head over to awaytravel.com/cattle and use promo code CATTLE during your checkout for $20 off of your suitcase. All right, now back to the show.
Well, this was a pretty big news story over the past couple of weeks, and when it was first reported, it didn't seem like it would end up a good news story. It was very, very scary when this was first being reported on. But thankfully, we can move forward and turn it into a good news story, because that's what it turned out to be.
What exactly are we talking about?
Well, 38-year-old Fort Worth native Joshua McClatchy was celebrating his birthday and decided to go on a hiking trip in the Buckeye Trail in the Caney Creek Wilderness area near Mena, Arkansas. This was on May 31st. Joshua works as a waiter and is in a social work graduate program. He was an experienced hiker, but this was fairly rugged terrain, and hikers pretty regularly get lost in this area because none of the trails are marked. So basically, when you go to this area, you have to rely on a compass and a map to really navigate this trail system. This was also the first time Joshua was going on a hike alone, so he had planned very carefully for this trip. But then, on June 1st, the next day, Joshua texted his mom and told her that he thought he was lost and that he was in trouble and that he needed help. His mother immediately contacted authorities, and rescue teams with search dogs were dispatched to Joshua's last known location, and aerial teams, both drones and helicopters, were also sent to scout for him. Search teams located his vehicle parked at the Buckeye Trailhead, but Joshua himself couldn't be located. His friends and family also volunteered for the search. They were terrified for him, knowing that he would have prepared well for this hike, but that he would have only packed so much food and water.
Oh man, so it's like the clock is running out.
Yeah, that's right. And during all of this, the weather in the area gets really bad. So that really dogs the rescue mission and delays some of the search parties as well. Meanwhile, while all of this is going on, many local businesses and townspeople donated food and water to the rescue teams as they continued their long searches for Joshua. Thankfully, at around 9 p.m. on June 7th, so this is 6 days after being missing and lost in the wilderness, a helicopter rescue team that was equipped with infrared technology spotted Joshua. They were able to radio to a ground search team and lead them to the area where Joshua was. He was located by the ground team after about an hour, and 3.5 hours after that, he was brought out of the wilderness, much to the delight of his family. His mother was there as he was being pulled out of the wilderness, and they were able to reunite, so that was very nice. Joshua was taken to a local hospital for evaluation. He only ended up suffering dehydration. He didn't really have any further injuries or anything, and he was released after treatment. Joshua later released statements calling his rescue miraculous. He commented on how good his first sips of water tasted after his rescue. And he also mentioned that he would like a slushy and that a tiger's blood snow cone sounded awfully good.
Oh, yeah.
Which, that would be me. That would be my first go-to. The first thing I would think about would be food. Joshua also said, quote, "Finally, I want to thank anyone who has ushered kind thoughts, love, and prayers from around the world. It is overwhelming and it means so much to me." Because while this was going on, this 6-day period while he was lost, I mean, this was really huge news. Everybody was reporting on it. People were reaching out to the family and the friends and really giving them their love and their support. And so many people came out of the woodworks to participate in the searches, to donate food and water to the search teams and everything. So this was really a huge effort in locating him. And thankfully, he was found pretty well off, as well off as I think you can be after 6 days in the wilderness. So
yeah, it was a long time.
Yeah, and a pretty incredible story. And it really does sound like he did prepare very well for him to be lost and by himself for that long. And he walked away with it with, you know, no injuries and was just a little dehydrated.
Yeah, he must have watched some Les Stroud.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But yeah, so didn't happen in Texas, but it involved a Texas person. And
a Texan.
Yeah, and there were Texans on the search teams looking for him. So congratulations to Joshua for getting out of that sort of mess. And thankfully, you know, he was found safe and sound, and he can go back to being a graduate student, which is much less exciting than being lost in the wilderness.
Yeah, take that, Bear Grylls. All right, so welcome back to the show, and this is the part where we're going to talk about recommendations on a show that we've been enjoying recently, and this week we're going to talk about Going West, a true crime podcast. I've been really enjoying this show. It's up and coming. It's really hot right now. A lot of people are talking about Going West. Just to give you an idea about the show, It's hosted by Heath and Daphne, and they both discuss haunting details of different disappearances, murder cases, week by week. Recently, I just checked out two different episodes. The first one was episode 25 on Andrew Cunanan, and it was a really great episode from the 90s about this interesting guy who has some kind of like assassinator quality to his case. It's a lot of whodunit, like interesting clues that are dropped throughout the episode, and they have a very similar aesthetic to what we have on our show. So I think if you like All Crime, No Cattle, you're going to love Going West. The second one that I checked out was the Jody LaCronu episode, and that was from 1996 of this 23-year-old woman who is accused of murdering her mother. And there's a bunch of witnesses. Again, it's another like whodunit and follow the clues and figure out what you think at the end of the episode. There's a lot of like interviews that are done in this show, which I like a lot. Yeah, it's just a really well done show, really popular right now. And I think if you like our show, you'll love Going West. So go check out their promo right here.
What's going on, true crime fans? I'm your host, Heath.
And I'm your other host, Daphne.
And we're from Going West,
a true crime podcast where we discuss various murders, disappearances, and unsolved crimes.
We release new episodes every Monday, and each week we have a different case to dive into.
You can find us over on Instagram at Going West Podcast.
And on Twitter at Going West Pod.
Listen to some of our episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You can also find us over on Patreon, patreon.com/goingwestpodcast, where you can get exclusive, bonus, ad-free episodes every month.
If you're looking for a new true crime binge, check out Going West.
For everybody out there in the world, keep it real and stay weird.
Cheerio.
Okay, thank you for tuning in to the after show. We're going to read off some Patreon names in just a second. But first off, let's go over some of our social media in case you want to get in touch or you want to find out some more details about any of the cases that we cover. You can find us on Instagram at All Crime No Cattle, on Twitter at ACNC Podcast. We have a Facebook page that you can find if you just search All Crime No Cattle. We also have a Facebook discussion group, which is ACNC Posse Discussion Group. We're having a blast in there. It's a pretty fun time, so you're more than welcome to join if you're interested. And of course, you can send us a line at allcrimenocattle@gmail.com. And before we get any further, I do want to brag a little about my sweet tattoo that I got.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Well, we went down to the Sinner's Tattoo Expo over in Dallas. We were poking our head around trying to figure out something that we wanted. Pretty much, I made the instantaneous decision to get a tattoo, and what better tattoo to get than the Yellow Rose of Texas. And so I was able to get a piece done by Ben Amos. He is of Rebel Muse Tattoo. They are in, where are they in again?
They are in Lewisville, Texas.
Yeah, in Lewisville, and he did a really great job. I believe his Insta handle is at Ben Dead Tattoos if you're interested in checking him out. I am there on his Instagram now. So very excited. It's all peely and gross looking right now, but hopefully it looks nice here in the future. So kind of a nod to the podcast and to the great state of Texas.
Yeah, and if you want to see that, go ahead and head over to our social media, like Aaron said, and check that out. Well, for now, we have to give some respect. We have to give some shout outs to all of our awesome Patreon supporters, especially our show producers, the Texas Rangers. And I'm talking about Steph White, Matthew McConnell, Serial Killer Sweets, Cat Williams, Dom Maloney, Andrew Margerison, Mel Thomas, Lisa Layton. You are our all-star Texas Rangers. Thank you so much for supporting the show. We really appreciate your constant support, your continued donations month by month. You guys are just freaking awesome. Next up, we have our small town sheriffs, and we need to thank Janet L. Ward, Nikki Aldridge, Laura Romaine, Christina Miller, Rory Williams, Mickey N, Molly Smith, Danny Jordan, Elizabeth Campbell, Angela Walker, Rebecca, and Ashley Parker. Thank you so much, guys. our small town sheriffs and our Texas Rangers. Your support is so important to us and keeping the show going, you know, supporting all of our costs and everything. We're headed to Chicago next month to do a big meetup, and we wouldn't be able to do that without you guys' support. And hopefully we get to meet some of you guys up in Chicago, and that would be awesome. We have some more Texas meetups coming up in the next couple of months. I think we're going to San Antonio in September, which will be close to Aaron's birthday. So maybe we'll be able to celebrate Aaron's birthday down in San Antonio with some of you Texas fans. That'll be cool. But until then, I don't have anything else unless you have something else, Aaron.
Nope, that's everything for me.
All right. Well, always remember that crime is bigger in Texas, y'all. Adios.
Bye.